It's 93.3 WMMR. I'm Pierre Robert with Matt Cord and Nick McElwain, and we have the pleasure of the company of the lead singer of Pearl Jam. Their album Lightning Bolt came out 1 week ago today. Eddie Vedder, welcome to MMR. Welcome back to Philly.
Nice place you got here.
First of all, happy 23rd anniversary. Today is the 23rd anniversary of the band.
I didn't know that until about 4 o'clock.
Okay. Now, these guys know, they're such aficionados, they know exactly where the first date was. Where was it, Matt?
It was at the Off-Ramp Cafe. Yes, you were Mookie Blaylock.
That is correct.
And you played Release.
I don't even know if we had a name yet.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I saw some video of it, and it looked like Stone did the most of the talking that night.
I'm sure it wasn't me.
I want to start by asking you about the place that used to be across the street, and that, of course, is the Spectrum. You guys came and closed it, and we're coming up on that anniversary 4 years ago this month. Four nights at the Spectrum, amazing, passionate evenings. And as we're all fans, and we love the city and love our audience at MMR, we love that building for so many reasons, but the emotion that you continue to put out, each of us were at all four shows, was so potent, so powerful, so from the heart. From your perspective, what were those four nights like?
I remember the confetti at the end.
That was cool.
I remember the woman with the, you know,
the cigarette girl.
Yeah.
She was giving the score of the World Series.
And I remember feeling a responsibility, you know, to the building, because you're talking about The Who and Pink Floyd and, of course, Springsteen, who was still playing it, you know, a month before we got there, he was playing three and four shows there, too. So it was really, you know, it was like somebody passed you the ball, you know, and you had a chance to kind of shoot the ball with 2 seconds left in the fourth quarter, you know. That's what it felt like. So it felt like, you know, we had to make that one in. It felt like a responsibility, you know.
But it seemed like a joyous one.
Oh, that's for sure. You know, and with, you know, the crowd bringing it the way they did, you know, that's what really, you know, that's always what's going to make it, you know.
I read a quote from you. You said, "There's a powerful act of some kind of spiritual revelation happening by playing together on a nightly basis in front of an audience and receiving the energy from that large a group of people." And putting it in a spiritual context, I get that, not only at those Spectrum shows, but everywhere I've seen you. Because whether I stand back out of the flow and just watch the interaction between band and audience, or whether I jump in the flow and am part of the audience sending the love, I get the spirituality, but is there a way of another way of defining that?
I mean, I don't think that was probably the right definition, and I don't think there really, I don't think you'd want to dissect it or try to quantify it or bottle it or depend on it. You know, it really is a surprise every time it happens, you know, and you don't know if it'll, you can't guarantee that it's going to happen even tonight in Philadelphia. You just don't know. And it's harder for, it doesn't happen as often on Sundays.
Really?
It's very, you know, it's just something that you can't, you know, it's like a horse, you know, it's bigger than you. And it'll kick your ass if you're not respectful and, you know, you don't know how to kind of react around it or ride it. You know, it's the bigger, more powerful thing than you are. I think that's why you're not nervous or edgy before you play, because you've never done it before. You're just wondering what's going to happen. Something's going to happen. You just don't know what.
Was that your, I mean, you've played some of the most historic venues in the world, Boston Garden and the Spectrum, Chicago Stadium, and I don't think you've ever played Fenway.
No.
But you played Wembley, and I saw you at the Arena in Verona, which was built in 15 AD. But I was thinking Wrigley had to be the cream of the crop for you.
Just because, for me, historically, because it was probably the first, like, venue that I ever went to. My grandfather took me to baseball game when I was 5 years old or 6 years old, and it was, you know, stomping grounds as a young kid. Uh-huh. So
do you remember the night, or do you just remember the fact that it rained and you're trying to figure out how to?
I remember every second of the phone call with the head meteorologist in Chicago. And I remember talking with Ernie Banks a little bit.
That's pretty cool.
In the back, but everything else was a blur, which I was saying this to a friend of mine the other day. He was asking about it. I said, well, he goes, yeah, it must have been like a dream come true. I said, well, it was. And it's, you know, often you don't remember your dreams. You know?
Yeah.
Speaking of dreams, you've had what most people would consider amazing dreams coming true in terms of some of the people you've played with, from the Rolling Stones to obviously Bruce Springsteen and The Who. But the most recent of those was Roger Waters almost a year ago, 12-12-12, the benefit at MSG, Madison Square Garden, for Sandy, where he brought you out, much to everyone's surprise, and you partnered with him on Comfortably Numb. You guys played Mother last night from Pink Floyd, but what was that like, singing with Roger Waters in that venue at that place?
Yeah, that Roger's definitely, you know, he's the teacher that you want to impress. And also that song for so many people and that record, you know. I mean, I would think there's more people of my generation that would know the words to that song more than they would know the Star Spangled Banner. It's a bit of an undertaking. You know?
Well, another great moment that I was lucky enough
you
to
you want to be in the moment, but you're the whole time you're thinking, you know.
Right.
Don't f*** up.
Well, another great moment I saw at the end of the Vote for Change
all
tour.
All those times that you spent listening to it, you know, high as a kite.
Yeah.
And now it's, yeah.
Here you go.
Yeah.
Where are the lyrics?
So you were high in just a different way, you know.
At the end of the Vote for Change tour, the very last show was at the Meadowlands, and yeah, you came on with Bruce. And I love it when people sing other people's songs together. And if memory serves me correct, I think you sang Darkness on the Edge of Town with Bruce, with the E Street Band backing you up, and then he sang Better Man. And I said, that is an extraordinary moment. Again, these moments for you, I don't know if they strike you that kind of way or not, but you said to the audience, he's the boss, we're just the employees. It was a great line, everyone roared.
Oh, yeah, 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 because he kind of put in the request. You know, it was nice. I mean, what he really did was, and I wasn't expecting that, he really handed me the keys to the E Street Band. You know, I showed up at soundcheck, and they were all there at 4 o'clock, ready to try this thing, and they allowed me to throw out a couple ideas as far as an arrangement. So it became more of an E Street Band arrangement. You know, it started with Roy on the piano, as you would if it were a E Street arrangement. And then instead of the guitar solo, it really started with Clarence. You know, he came in with the sax solo. So, you know, that not only did he give me the keys and, you know, I didn't know if I knew how to drive it, but the car responded, and you could take that thing around corners and leap it in.
It's a nice mobile.
It kind of got, we got that thing,
yeah,
cruising that night. And I've had a few, you know, some of the great moments on stage has been, you know, collaborating with other people, and that for sure was one of them.
We got to talk last night briefly about the song Last Kiss, and I remember getting it 98 on the 45 and going into the studio and carting it up on a cart, and we started playing it here in Philadelphia. And then you mentioned, I think 8 years ago, from maybe this room, that, you know, it's funny, it all started here in Philadelphia. So I'm kind of patting myself on the back.
You should. I'll punch
it. But are you surprised that I think I got the number 2 on the Hot 100 Billboard charts?
What I remember, it was must have been in January or something. We had finished work, and I disappeared far off, somewhere far away, kind of a remote spot in the Hawaiian Islands, and I hadn't seen people for, you know, I could go for a week or two without seeing people. I'd get some supplies, and I had a Jeep, and I was living in kind of the jungle. And it was almost like pre-cell phone. It was for me. So at some point, someone finally got a hold of me, and they said, did you hear what's happening? And I said, no. They said, well, the song is kind of being played everywhere. And I thought, well, that's completely bizarre. And didn't really kind of believe it, and was just kind of like, okay. You know, and it just didn't really equate with the way I was living at that point, which is really kind of off the grid and, you know, eating fruit off the trees and fish out of the water.
Sounds like, you know, Into the Wild.
Little bit, but
yeah, it does.
I chose a warmer spot. But the funny thing is, now Hawaii is not known for their great rock and roll radio. They've got, you know,
yeah,
a few things going there, which is great. But so I get in this Jeep and I turn on. I go to town to get my supply. I turn on the radio, And there it was. It was playing on the, I mean, of all things. And out in the middle of nowhere. And I thought that was a little strange, crazy, and exciting. And I thank you for that moment.
We're speaking with Eddie Vedder on MMR, Matt Cord and Nick McElwain, and myself, Pierre. The album, a week old now, Lightning Bolt, has so many great songs on it. Sirens is one of the first besides Mind Your Manners. And I love Sirens. I love how it goes down in concert. What about that song strikes you?
It's not for me to decide. I get too close to these things, and I guess right now we're just in a moment where we can, you know, it's been out, it's, you know, kind of been put out there for public scrutiny, and people seem to be responding to it. So I don't know. I have a really hard time being asked those kind of questions. I want to be a team player with you here, but I just don't know how to answer it. It's kind of something that you're in the moment, you try to grab that moment, and then you're kind of off to the next, and maybe that one gets you to the next. But, you know, it's always nice if you know, because you usually think that when you write a song and you deem that it's finished, you think that, well, people will like that or you like it, but you never know. You just never know. So it's nice to get good feedback.
The record is so cool, and I played it on vinyl yesterday. On my show, I do a vinyl feature every afternoon, and I love it when current bands release stuff on vinyl. So I play newer
stuff.
With
the scratches already included.
I played Led Zeppelin 2 was released today, and I played two songs, and it was scratchy, and you could absolutely hear the scratches.
I heard it in my car. I turned it up just to hear the scratches.
But you don't hear it anymore.
Yeah.
You know, and I love vinyl, and I think you do too. It's three-dimensional. It's larger than life. You know, you can sit and look at the artwork and get into the record and go places. Do you have a large vinyl collection?
It would fill this room.
Really?
Wow.
We're in a giant locker room, I might add.
An NHL locker room, a basketball locker room. Yeah, it's really big.
Or at least that wall. Probably.
That's
wall.
Very cool.
You got to keep up with it. It's difficult to manicure.
Right. Salute you for continuing to put out vinyl. Nick, did you have a question?
Well, I'm a little nervous, so I wrote mine down, Ed, because I'm a huge fan. So I wanted to frame it properly. For you, surfing and painting and even throwing axes, these activities all serve as a method to help you relax or escape so that you can eventually return to your work, which is making music. And for me and millions of other people around the world, we find our escape by listening to the music of you, by listening to Pearl Jam. Is that aspect of the relationship between the band and its fans important to you in the songwriting process? Do you realize that what you guys do has so much import for guys like me?
That's a really good question. And
thank you, Eddie Vedder.
Oh, we're going to hear that on the air forever.
Oh, we're going to hear that forever.
It wasn't the best question. It's up there.
Okay.
I think in a lot of ways you can't think about that. You have to. I don't know how to explain it exactly, because again, you're dissecting something that's a little bit. It's always morphing. It's something that, you know, writing a song or something or being it's cell division. It's some weird one-celled amoeba type creation that then starts cell dividing and then gets bigger, and you're not really sure. So. And when you start kind of thinking about what other people think or what you think or what other people think about what you think, or does this person going to think that it's about them because they're your neighbor and they know that you don't like them or anything. You just don't – you want to kind of protect that in a way the song stays in like an incubator for a while, you know.
And until a point, though, because I think your songs among – your songs have a life to themselves, the band's songs, and they evolve. They become different when you see them live. They sometimes start as a ukulele song and then become a Pearl Jam song and then become a different song when they are played in an arena. So the songs themselves often have a life.
Yeah. Good point.
Thank you.
I don't know.
Eddie, what's the journal?
But I do like the axe swing's good. You know, the axe swing's really good.
Do you like that?
it's therapeutic, and it's very healthy, and it's everyone should have one in their den, living area.
Ed, you walk out with
it. I think, you know, really, instead of darts and bars and stuff, I mean, I know the insurance would be high, but the axe throwing at it.
Are you a good axe thrower? Would you consider yourself?
You don't think it would be a drinking game, but it's
like, does Jeff come over and throw axes with you?
Yeah, he's throwing some axes.
Okay, because I know he's pretty athletic, too.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he can. His is more like a jump shot.
One last question, because we have to let you go. But in terms of this amazing ride tonight, again being your 23rd anniversary, do you ever ponder the fact that out of the just awful tragedy that was the end of Mother Love Bone, out of that death came this birth of this amazing other entity? The irony of it, the strange twist of fate. Do you ever stop and think how that flowed and where you guys have gone as a result of these bizarre circumstances that kind of fell?
Yeah, that's a tricky one. I mean, I think about it all the time, and the same way I think about, you know, Chris McCandless or someone like that, who's become part of your life, you know, somebody that you never thought you'd kind of come in contact, and then all of a sudden they're part of your life. I mean, I think about Jeff and Stone and what they've been through. I think about the community in Seattle. I think about the other members that used to play in bands with Andrew Wood. And, you know, it's funny because I remember seeing pictures on Jeff's wall, and it might have been Dobbs. It might have been, they did a small tour early on. Maybe
they
on
did
their,
come through Dobbs.
Their EP, yeah.
Yeah, he had his mountain bike on that tour, he's telling me.
Right.
Jeff did. That's when he first came to the Spectrum.
And I believe the shots of Andy were him in a Sixers jersey. And he was like walking on the bar. I remember the stories. Because I was listening intently, thinking, you know, I hope someday we get to play Philadelphia. So I know that he would love playing these kind of rooms. And you know, the fact that, you know, it's in a way, it's kind of symbolizes the group, you know, that you were able to take an incredibly harsh and difficult situation and create something out of it, you know, that something can grow out of it, you know. And, you know, I was bringing stuff about, you know, what I'd been through in my life to the group and to the lyrics and to the overall feeling of appreciating being alive. And they were getting through something that was, you know, it's about as heavy as you can go. It is as heavy as you can get to as a band. And then, of course, we went through heavy things in Denmark. And you know, just always being able to persevere, I suppose.
Carry on.
I mean, it's really, look, life happens. Life and it's happening to everybody. And if you don't, I was talking about the other night, if you don't have the scars, you're gonna. And if you think you're going to get out of here without the scars and you're not going to be broken at some point, fooling yourself. And if you were to get through somehow unscathed, well, you probably didn't get the full meaning of life, you know. So it's really, you know, always kind of trying to aim high and help others and protect others and look out for the future of our planet and all us humans on it, you know. It's you do what you can do, but I think it's not getting around the fire. It's getting through it, and it's not even just that. It's how you get through it, you know.
Eddie, thanks so much for speaking with us on MMR. We really appreciate your time, and welcome back to Philly.
It's been my pleasure. You know, one thing, I was reminded as you were saying about talking about that place, the off ramp. What I remember from that was. And it'll be interesting, now I'm remembering, because it's all these years later. We did a sound check, and it was the first sound check. And we'd only met six, 7 days before then. I think it was the sixth day we had been playing together. I talked to Jeff over the phone a few times, maybe Stone, and Kim Thile from Soundgarden. Mm-hmm. So we practiced for maybe 5 days. I don't know what we were thinking playing the show. None of us know what we were thinking, if you ask us now. And then the seventh day we recorded. So we're the sixth day or whatever, and we go in. I remember doing the sound check, And we were like the last one to sound check because we were the first one to play, you know. And we were going to play at 9 o'clock or something. I don't think sound check was till like the other bands were running late. Sound check was like 8:30. So there's no one in the club. We start doing the song, and I think it was Release. I remember just closing my eyes so I could hear, and the monitors weren't great. You know, it was a pretty shit little club, still is. And then close my eyes. When I opened my eyes at the end of the song, the place was practically full. They had opened the doors and people had walked in. So it's just kind of interesting. You know, I played on many the stage in little groups and all that, and very rarely had a crowd, you know. 5, 10, 15, 20, maybe 50 people here and there, or 60 if they were there to see somebody else. So it was kind of a crazy thing to, you know, 1 second your eyes were closed, you started the song, you open them, there was a crowd. And it's really what happened to the group. That's so I just want to thank the fellas in our group for putting some faith in this guy here, and I want to thank you guys for the same.
Thank you, Ed. Thanks, Ed.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Picking 5 of Carrie Underwood's best music videos was no easy task, but after some debate, we landed on 5 we believe rise to the top. Did Carrie's 2014 hit Something in the Water make our top 5? Find out when you text Carrie to 45911 and scroll through the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Carrie to 45911 to get your eyes on our favorite Carrie Underwood music videos.